We're so used to thinking about 1940 and Dunkirk in British terms that it's interesting now to think about what that period and the years that followed it meant for people in another European country, our closest neighbour, France. So the 10th of May 1940, the Germans invaded France at very high speed and in strength using their new technique, which was called lightning war, blitzkrieg, which meant armoured invasion, tanks and armoured cars moving fast across the flat country in the northern part of Europe, and bomber planes and fighter planes overhead, and the whole thing followed up by infantry, so that within hours, within days, whole countries fell, absolutely stunned and devastated by the onslaught. There was, as you know, a defensive line called the Maginot Line across France, but it didn't go into Belgium, so it was easy to get around the north. It had also been designed with the guns all facing eastwards so, and incapable of turning round, so that once the Germans had penetrated the Maginot Line, that was the end of them. Italians are trying to get used to what's been happening so fast to the north of them. Somebody says, "Ah, well, the Maginot Line is impenetrable," and Danilo says, "Yes, indeed, but they have penetrated it." Within 2 weeks, the British forces, which were in France anticipating an attack, had been swept back to the sea, and so had forces allied with theirs, including elements of the French army. The evacuation of British and some French Turks from troops from Dunkirk began, I don't think any Turks were involved at this stage, began on the 27th of May and lasted a week. A day after the Dunkirk rout ended on the 5th of June, German tanks and bombers turned back on Paris. Hundreds of thousands of civilians fled from the city to the provinces. The government itself decamped to Bordeaux in the south, in the southwest, and on the 10th of June declared Paris an open city, that's to say an undefended city. They let everybody know that there was no defense in Paris. That's something that's a way, among other things, of preventing a city from being destroyed. You declare it's open, there's no point in the enemy shelling it and bombing it. France surrendered entirely 12 days later on the 22nd of June, so that within a month and a bit of the first invasion, France had fallen. It was initially divided into two regions. The north and the west were governed directly by the occupying Germans. The southern, southeastern region, which was more conservative and was thought to be less hostile, and which was also less in the main line of action as far as Britain was concerned, was handed over to a sympathizing French government under Marshal Pétain, our dear Maréchal, as the Vicomtesse de Montmore calls him in Suite Française. Hundreds of thousands of French troops were taken prisoner and exported to Germany, and we see some of the consequences of that in the two novellas that you've been reading. Meanwhile, France was required to pay the costs of the German army of occupation. It's an important fact, this. You think about, for a largely agricultural country, the loss, but with quite a lot of industry, the loss of so many men who were previously working on the land or in industry, and secondly, the fact that the country not only had to feed itself, but had to pay the notional costs, the costs that were set by the occupying army, of the army that was occupying them. All of this led, combined with difficulties in transport, led to food shortages. And now, later, in 1942, when the Allies invaded North Africa, the south side of the Mediterranean, the south of France clearly became vulnerable. So at that stage, the Germans also occupied the south of France, not just, they didn't just rule it under Pétain, but they directly occupied it. And this was when the first deportations of Jews really got going in earnest. There are many, many debates about the degree of collaboration between the French and the Germans over the deportation of Jews. It's clear that the main initiation came from Germany, but it's also clear from quite a lot of recent scholarship that the French authorities not only collaborated keenly, but often initiated and encouraged the deportation of the Jews. I apologize to any French students who may be here, but they'll be aware of this, and we know that they themselves and their generation are not responsible, and also that our own country has its own history of terrible actions in the past as well as in the present. Among the victims of the Holocaust of French citizens who were Jews were Irene Nemirovsky, who died in Auschwitz, and her banker husband, whose name was Michel Epstein. Now, the two interconnected, and it's important to remember, unfinished novellas, which make up Suite Française, were written in France between 1940 and 1942, that's to say between the fall of France and Irene Nemirovsky's murder in Auschwitz. And much of what they describe derives from her own experiences in that period. With her husband Epstein, Nemirovsky escaped Paris in the early summer of 1940 and went to live in a village in a hilly region, in a hilly area of the Burgundy region, the sort of central France, called Issy-l'Évêque. And Bussy in Suite Française is clearly modeled on Issy. Their two daughters had already been evacuated to that village, and they were joined there in the summer of 1940 by their parents. Now, you have to imagine that, you have to know that when Nemirovsky moved to Issy-l'Évêque, she was a highly successful, highly commercial, famous writer. She was a very, very well-known writer in France. She was Russian by origin, as her name suggests. Her family, her father was a rich banker, and I'll come back to rich bankers in a moment, left Kiev to escape from the Russian Revolution when she was 14, and they settled in Paris. Like most bourgeois cosmopolitan Russians of the time, the Nemirovskys used French as their lingua franca, as the language in which they spoke to their friends and to people from other countries. So she adapted quickly in France. She went to the Sorbonne, to university, and she began writing fiction in French when she was still in her teens. Think again about that background, escape from the Russian Revolution and the implied hostility to communism and sense of what it might have brought. And a wealthy, conservative world, and one that saw France as a kind of home, but also saw it from outside and had a critical, was it capable of taking a critical line on it. Her work was first published in her early 20s. The handout is really just titles and names of people and a few quotations so that I don't have to write them up on the board or something. Her second novel, which is listed there, published in 1929, was called David Golda. It was an immediate hit. It was made into a movie by Julien Duvivier, and it was his first big success as a movie. And other books by her were adapted for stage and screen. So like Morm, she was a successful commercial writer with a big name, and she was translated into English. David Golda was published in the USA, as was Jezabel in 1936. She not only wrote fiction, but a biography of Chekhov, which was published after her death in France, and again it was published in translation in the US and in the UK. Now, Suite Française, as I said, was written between 1940 and 1942, and she didn't finish it because she was taken away to Auschwitz. And it took very much longer to see the light. It was conceived, as you know if you've read the introduction, and I recommend you to read the introductory material on the apparatus at the back, the appendices, which are moving and revealing. I'll refer to them in a moment. It was conceived as part of what were to be five novels. We can't know how they would have developed, what form they would have taken, or what form these two novellas that we have would have taken, how preliminary they are or how advanced. So all that has to continually be kept in mind when you're making judgments on the work as a work. The manuscript was inherited by Nemirovsky's elder daughter, Denise, and she thought at first glance that it was a kind of diary of her mother's life. She didn't even look at it much. She thought it was a record her mother had kept at that time, and she thought it was going to be too painful to read, so she put it aside. And it wasn't until the late 1990s, so in your lifetime, when she was arranging to donate boxes of her mother's papers to an archive, that she took a closer look and realized what it was and decided to offer it for publication. It appeared in 2004 in French. It won a major literary award. And among its first readers in French was Carmen Carlile, a Francophile Australian publisher and writer resident in England. She is one of the founders of Virago Press, which is one of the main feminist publishing houses in Britain in the 1980s and 90s. And she'd recently herself been working on a book about Vichy France called Bad Faith, which is on the handout. You may want to read it if you're interested in this particular period and in the background to Suite Française. She, Carmen Carlile, was passionate about the book and she promoted it energetically. It was published in English translation in 2006. That's the translation you've got. And it became an instant bestseller both in Britain and in the USA. Now, the questions obviously are, given that what we have is unfinished, is it a good book? Or is it, and this is what I want to focus on in part, what G.K. Chesterton and after him George Orwell called a good bad book? Or is it something else? Now, we have to remember that most of us, like most of its readers numerically in the world, know it only in translation, as well as the fact that it's unfinished. Despite those disadvantages, it undeniably gives us a very strong, suspenseful series of storylines and a detailed, generally indignant, but sometimes affectionate number of sketches of French society under pressure. The indignation, I think, is important because Nemirovsky is a satirist. She is particularly alert not only to the divisions between rich and poor, for example, but to quite separate divisions based on class and especially to the moral deformations which wealth and property and possessions bring to individuals and to groups of individuals. The moral deformations which great wealth not only derives from but nourishes. She has, I think exaggeratedly, been compared with Dostoevsky. But in this and other respects, I mean the ones I've just referred to, the more directly ethical fictions of another Russian writer, Nikolai Gogol, are, I think, more relevant. And other roots can be found in Gogol's French contemporary Balzac, and before him in the 17th century French dramatist Molière, with his caste lists of misers and opportunists and hypocrites. Most of Nemirovsky's characters, as you've seen, are defined by their possessions and their possessiveness with their possessions. The evacuation of Paris is conveyed as a crisis of transport, in terms not only of whether and how people can get to their destinations, but of how they can take their goods along with them. And in communicating this chaos, Nemirovsky selects character types whose particular relation to their possessions sharpens the inevitable irony. So we have the rich collector Charles Langelet wrapping up his porcelain. It has to be porcelain because not only valuable, but so terribly fragile. And he's going to take it on this dangerous trip. There's the Perricon family with its dependence on inherited wealth, waiting for its embroidered sheets to come back from the laundry before it sets off. There's Gabrielle's mistress Florence and her jewels acquired in the course of her dubious profession. Now, what distinguishes the modest Michaud family in all this, of course, one of the many things that distinguish them, they're arguably the heroes of the first of the novellas of these two, is that they trustingly leave their possessions behind tidily in their apartment in Paris, which they lock up, and off they go, and they meet with various betrayals and vicissitudes on their journey, but when they get back, everything is untouched. So that the implication is clearly that the concerns of the others were quite unnecessary. Trust, though, can be misplaced in these novellas, as is the fate of the priest, as the fate of the priest in the Pericon family illustrates, when these orphans brought up in a church orphanage find themselves with all discipline and order removed. They enact a kind of mini Russian revolution and kill the hapless and innocent priest himself and sack the nearby chateau. It's a strange sort of Golding-like Lord of the Flies episode which stands out from the rest of the novel, but it's bearing on ideas of conservatism and order is pretty clear, I think. Now, all this happens very rapidly. The variety of the characters, the violence, the justice in some cases of what befalls characters, the powerful sense of a much bigger and arbitrary violence on its way, all this carries along the reader and is counterparted by the unexpected calm of the second novella, the first half of the second novella. Here, while in Dolce, as it's called, sweet, while the satire on French snobbery and materialism continues and is developed, the melodrama of part one gives way to the romantic scenario of an impossible relationship between two unhappily married but idealistic people. In a way, this is a Franco-German version of Noel Coward's Brief Encounter, a pre-war work which gained a post-war popularity because of its appeal to those who had experienced wartime separations and fidelities. The difference, of course, is that Lucille and Bruno were on opposite sides in the Second World War, and that Nemirovsky deploys the relationship as a way not only of commenting on the meaninglessness of war, of what I mentioned last week has been described as the European Civil War, between countries so closely allied and aligned at different periods, but of depicting a good German. And one of the fascinations of this book is that written at the time that it was, that is one of the things it sets out to do. Now, I'll be offering a different interpretation in a moment, but I would like to suggest first that despite the more ambitious claims that have been made for it, Suite Française, as we have it in its unfinished form, is a good bad book. A good bad book, as Orwell anatomized that phenomenon in his essays. He wrote in Good Bad Books, 1945, one can be amused or excited or even moved by a book, we would add TV series or movie, I'm sure, a book that one's intellect simply refuses to take seriously. Art is not the same thing as cerebration. In novelists, almost as much as in poets, the connection between intelligence and creative power is hard to establish. Enough talent, he says, to set up dozens of ordinary writers has been poured into Wyndham Lewis's so-called novels, such as Tar or Snooty Baronet. Yet it would be very heavy labour to read these books right through. Some indefinable quality, a sort of literary vitamin, is absent from them. Now, it's important to recognize that Orwell is not, although Good Bad Books sounds patronizing, he's trying to find a way of talking about books which genuinely appeal to us, which are good, but which are not intellectually complicated or satisfying, and which you might say, by virtue of that lack of an intellectual quality, tend not to find themselves on university curricula, at least in literary departments as distinct from cultural studies departments. That they might more often in film studies departments. And how those processes of selection and discrimination, possibly false discrimination, occur is something that you need to be continually thinking about and something you need to be bearing in mind in your considerations of the more difficult works that you encounter, especially in our course in the modernist period. Now, there's more going on in Orwell's essay than might appear. Among other things, his account of the fiction of Wyndham Lewis, an exact contemporary of Virginia Woolf, whom Orwell also found unreadable, by the way. Orwell didn't like Virginia Woolf. Arguably introduces a category he doesn't mention, the bad good book. I think I wouldn't describe Virginia Woolf in that case. I think of Virginia Woolf as a great writer. But Wyndham Lewis is, to me, a bad good writer in the sense that he has extraordinary talent and vigor and skill with language and imagination and cleverness. But he really is pretty much unreadable, to me at any rate. He was a very good painter, and the originality and strikingness of his vision is able to come through in painting because it's there straight away for you. You don't have to labor through and try and work out all the time what's happening. Some people would argue that Henry Green fits into the category of a bad good writer. I, of course, don't, but so this is up in the up for judgment and for your judgment. Now, for now, though, talking about Nemirovsky, what Orwell has to say is particularly useful, I think, because it can be applied to some of the differences between her and her contemporaries Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir, who were both philosophical novelists, and both of whom wrote novels set in wartime France, set, like Suite Française, in wartime France. Indeed, Sartre's La Mort dans l'âme, The Iron in the Soul, 1949 in French, which is the third part of a trilogy, includes a powerful depiction of the flight from Paris. And Simone de Beauvoir's Le sang des autres, The Blood of Others, which was made into a movie by Claude Chabrol, is about, among other things, moral dilemmas involved in resistance to an occupying power. So both those writers are dealing with very similar material to Irene Nemirovsky's. And again, if you find yourself wanting to focus on her and develop your thinking about her, you should probably compare her with one or other or both of those writers. They both, Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir, seem to me as fiction writers to exemplify what Orwell describes as over-cerebration, too much brain work. In fiction. The ideas they discuss and embodied are intellectually absorbing, but the characters too often don't come to life, and it can be difficult to tell who is who and what's happening. None of those things are a problem in Irene Nemirovsky. From the perspective of this module, all these three writers, of course, concern themselves with the modern world and with what's happening in it, and exemplify the relation between the writer as an individual and those actions. Both Sartre and de Beauvoir were involved in the French resistance and in, not only in that, but in left-wing activism after the war ended. And in de Beauvoir's case, her book Le Deuxième Sexe, The Second Sex, 1949, is a crucial text in second wave feminism. I said all three writers, but I meant those two. Can we make comparable claims for Nemirovsky in terms of their of an engagement, a political engagement, an attempt to tell the truth about difficult circumstances in France? Well, clearly, Suite Française has valuable and critical things to say about materialism. it also, movingly, juxtaposes. Nobody's got any water by any chance, have they? They could. Has anybody got a bottle of water they could let me? Thank you so much. Thanks. Thanks a lot. Sorry about that. It also makes a dynamism between the tribalist simplifications of warfare for enemy and friend, Germans and French, with the complexities of human action in everyday life and also in history. So, for example, Kurt Bonnet, as he pronounces himself, who is the exploitative bad German who is billeted on the Savary family, points out that his surname is French in origin. He's Bonnet. Lucille entertains Bruno to tea off First Empire China, which commemorates France's military expansionism throughout Europe in the era of Napoleon, when, in other words, France was behaving as Germany is behaving at that time. Earlier, when a woman escaping from Paris alongside the Michaud couple exclaims, "There has never been anything as horrible as this," Maurice Michaud replies, "On the contrary, madame, on the contrary." In other words, it's always happening. The intense philanthropic Vicomtesse de Montmore, meanwhile, has ideas which are decidedly fascistic about the future of the white race. This is a quotation. "Or the threat posed by the Freemasons and communism." And it's her sympathy with the Germans that leads indirectly to the incident which forces Benoit into hiding. Benoit is a sort of one-man resistance figure, though to me it's quite significant that Benoit does not belong to any organization, any organized resistance. He's an individual reacting in personal ways to his own situation. But what about that other threat, in inverted commas, which obsessed Nazism, the one supposedly posed by the Jews? It's mentioned in passing in a reference to an anti-Semitic poster put up by the Germans in Bussy. But Sweet Française has nothing else to say on this matter. In general, the book's approach to the invasion and to Nazism is that while both involve great suffering, France has behaved just as badly in the past, and in the present is so rotten with corruption, materialism, greed, and so on, that a good shake-up may ultimately be for the good. Individually, meanwhile, the Germans we meet are, with exceptions, for the most part, civilized, well-behaved, fine physical specimens. It's worth asking whether, if the book had been chosen by Joseph Goebbels for publication throughout France, any changes would have been thought necessary. You might think about that. If you were a Nazi and you thought, well, this novel is going to be published, Sweet Française, what is it all right? What would you have thought? That is the nub of the question that I'm moving towards. Well, it's true that there's the plot involving Benoit, but it's presented partly as the flip side of the Bruno Lucille story, husband injured by bad Germans' unscrupulous advances on his wife, and partly as a purely class-based drama, the hungry versus the rich. It's not specifically national or political, and as I said, Benoit is not part of a major movement. We tend always, don't we, since the Romantic movement, we've tended to think of literature in relation to politics as oppositional. It is anti-conservative, it favors democracy and liberty and radical causes. Writers, in a popular phrase Edward Said used a lot, but which actually goes back to the Quaker movement, interestingly, speak truth to power. But there have been many great writers in history, right back to classical times, whose relation to the status quo was one of support, even propaganda. And just as there is resistance literature, so there is literature of, one might want to put it this way in this particular specific context, literature of collaboration. To me, Irène Nemirovsky's work has to face this charge. And one of the grimmest ironies of her life story, which I think, although we must always distinguish between a writer and his or her work, and must be careful of naively biographical readings of literature, works are produced by writers. Writers are human beings. Their experience tends to go into their work. And there are texts whose meaning is partly or largely determined by the circumstances in which they were produced and published. If you doubt this, ask yourself whether Anne Frank's diary would mean anything if you didn't know what happened to Anne Frank after the diary finishes. And I believe the same must be true of Suite Française, that the fact that we know that Nemirovsky went to Auschwitz, and that's why this book is unfinished, is an important part of its effect on us. But, as I say, one of the grimmest ironies of reading her book in this way, whereas Anne Frank, in her diary, thinks a lot about the position of Jews, and as she matures in the diary, reflects on anti-Semitism, as well as on the position of women in wars, and has some very mature and critical things to say about all that. There's nothing of that in Nemirovsky's novel, nothing about anti-Semitism. And in fact, she had contributed significantly to the climate of opinion in France between the wars, which made it relatively easy for Nazism to be assimilated and for the French authorities to cooperate in the final solution from 1942 on, of which she was an early victim. As I said, one of her most successful novels commercially was David Golder, and it was made into a film and into a stage play. Like a lot of fictions published throughout the Western world in the 1920s, it's set in the world of the super rich. I'm thinking of Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby, or even in War's File Bodies, 1930. Unlike many such stories, though, it is a satire which understands the vulnerability of the wealthy, both in psychological terms and in economic terms. And in that sense, the book speaks to us today with its character of a banker. 1929, of course, when the novel was published, was the year of a great crash. And the stock market crash, which led to the global depression. The central character, David Golder, is a banker. And the first word he and the book utter is no. And Golder is saying no to his old friend Simon Marcus about a speculation, a financial speculation, which has to succeed if Marcus is to avoid ruin. And Golder refuses to help his old friend, and Marcus commits suicide. All this happens within the first 9 pages. Nemirovsky doesn't hang about as a writer. It happens while Golder is on a business trip, and it's not until page 28 of the novel, almost a fifth of the way through, it's a short novel, that we see him on his home territory. He has a tough, exploitative wife with whom he lives on terms of mutual hatred, and a spoilt daughter, Joyce, on whom he dotes, who's more affectionate towards him, but only when she runs out of money. Both the mother and the daughter are in love with men, other than David Golder, who have no money of their own. And their affairs, in both cases, are indirectly and unwillingly being financed by Golder. All this is done with relentlessly bleak plausibility and with Nemirovsky's usual attention to possessions, cars, furniture, clothes, jewelry. You really see these people in their wealth and possessions. Now, it becomes clear as the book, as the narrative goes on, it becomes clear to everybody and Golder himself that he has a weak heart and also that his businesses are in trouble. The stock market crash is coming. He survives a heart attack, a coronary, but these events alert those dependent on him to their dependency, none more than his daughter, whose sexy, foodie relationship with the broke Alec, I said broke, not bloke, though he is a bloke, that she goes with this young man, Alec, who's got no money, on a long holiday in pre-Republican Spain. And they have a great time, and it's described in sensual detail. But we've all the time got in the back of our minds, you know, where is this money coming from that these kids are enjoying so much? I don't mean to make too much of this point or to look at you too keenly, but you see what I'm getting at. Now, when Golder loses his money, and out of a mixture of illness and wanting to teach Joyce a lesson, refuses to pursue a potentially lucrative oil concession in his native Russia, Joyce says to him, if you don't do this, I'm going to have to marry a rich old man. And there's one in question who Golder detests. So the idea of his daughter marrying this person is hateful to him. And his attachment to his daughter is so intense that he decides he's got to cave in to what she says. He's got to make his daughter independently rich. He's got to keep his financial empire together. And these oil concessions are probably the answer to that. He's exhausted and sick, but he nonetheless makes a trip to Russia. And he spends weeks battling over the fine details of a contract for this oil concession. All that is brilliantly done. Nemirovsky knows this stuff so well. She's a young writer in her early 20s. Somebody wrote, and I can't remember who it was, how can someone in her mid-20s know so much and so well about the harsh terms money dictates to love? About the harsh terms money dictates to love. And that's absolutely right. In making his daughter rich, Golda carries out what it is suggested in the text is an evolutionary requirement that has also been met by his friend Seufer, who the text says, this is still David Golda, the novel I'm in, would die, this is a quotation, would die all alone like a dog, without a friend, without a single wreath on his grave, buried in the cheapest cemetery in Paris by his family who hated him and whom he hated, but to whom he nevertheless left a fortune of some 30 million francs, thus fulfilling till the end the incomprehensible destiny of every good Jew on this earth, thus fulfilling the incomprehensible destiny of every good Jew on this earth. Now, there have been many attempts to defend Irene Nemirovsky against the charge of what Jews call racial self-hatred, against anti-Semitism. The most plausible and elaborate is by a British Jewish writer called Frederick Raphael. It's very sophisticated, and it places her in context in terms of class and tribal affiliations in Russia. And if anybody wants to follow this through, I've got copies of that article in my office. But I didn't want to burden you with them. In any case, I reluctantly actually disagree with Raphael. It seems to me that that statement, fulfilling the mysterious destiny of every good Jew on earth, is unmistakably a statement about Jews. It makes no distinction between Jews. It is merciless, the novel, in its onslaught on the values of rich Jews, as merciless as Suite Française is in relation to the provincial French middle class. That's an uncomfortable thing to say, but if I said, if I wrote a sentence saying, to whom he left a large country house, a flat in Belgravia, and enough money to leave his to have his children educated privately, thus fulfilling the incomprehensible destiny of every good Englishman, that would be a satirical statement against Englishmen, which in a particular context would not be regarded as culpable. But if subsequently large numbers of Englishmen were lumped together and sent to their deaths in gas chambers, would take on a whole different meaning. And that's the question, I think. How far Nemirovsky's words there have been overtaken by the very history which she helped to create with David Golda. Anyway, Golda is a self-made Jew. He and his wife both come from the ghetto, a fact which they remind each other of in a brutal scene. And as Golda ages, Nemirovsky depicts him as a stereotypical old ghetto Jew, wearing an old greatcoat, a woolen scarf around his neck, and a worn-out black hat, looking strangely like some Jewish second-hand clothes merchant from a village in the Ukraine. As he walked, he would sometimes raise one shoulder in a weary mechanical movement, as if he were hoisting a heavy bundle of clothing or scrap iron on his back. Now, there's plenty of anti-Semitic writing in the history of the West and of Russia, too. And as Orwell again has made clear to you, as to others, there was plenty of anti-Semitism in the Britain of the 1920s and 30s and 40s as well. So we have to allow for the fact that Nemirovsky's writing could not and did not have the resonance then that it had subsequently. And, as I've said repeatedly, she wrote as she found. She grew up in that world, she knew it. She is communicating a detestation of the kind of person that she herself encountered and disliked. However, because of its huge success, this book had an enormous impact and reinforced views which were already strong in France and which had resulted in a controversial trial at the turn of the century, the turn of the 19th to 20th century, involving a French Jew charged with treason, Albert Dreyfus, the Dreyfus case. Now, Nazism hadn't yet got going, and the ferocity of the Nazi campaign against the Jews only gradually became apparent. But her anti-Semitism and her writing about Jews in that way was not diminished by the events of the 1930s. Indeed, there's plenty of evidence to show that in this respect she took the side of the far right. She was a Catholic convert. She wrote for some of the most anti-Semitic French magazines of the 1930s, among them Gringoire. And it's been said of the last of her novels to be published in her lifetime, The Dogs and the Wolves, had a Nazi publishing house commissioned a novel stipulating the perpetuation of racial stereotypes, they would not have been disappointed with this as a result. When life became difficult for her as a Jew in occupation France, she implored the occupied France, she implored the authorities, among them Marshal Pétain himself, to acknowledge the difference between undesirable and desirable foreigners, to acknowledge the difference between undesirable and desirable foreigners. Now, the terrible and tragic story of Nemirovsky and her husband and their dealings with the regime in the early 1940s can be followed in the appendix to this book. New Nazi-directed French laws militated against them by, for example, forbidding newspapers to publish work by foreigners, and then, both more precisely and more broadly, excluding Jews from positions in cultural life. Money due to them, to Epstein and Nemirovsky from their publishers, was delayed, held up, not given to them. By September 1941, they were not allowed to leave their village. Remember, she's writing Sweet Française at this time. This is what's happening to her, and this is when she's writing Sweet Française. She's not able to publish, she's not able to get money from her publisher, she's confined to her village because she's Jewish. In July 1942, she was arrested, and you can read her brief, brave notes to her husband and children in the appendix to the book. Michel Epstein, who was still at large, still free, he was later himself arrested and murdered, appealed to everyone he knew, and some people he didn't, to help. He pointed out that they'd had Jewish troops billeted on them in their own house in Issy, and that they'd written them a glowing testimonial. He wrote to the German ambassador, pointing out not only that the families on both their sides were Russian anti-Bolsheviks, anti-communists, but that his wife's work, and I'm quoting from the translation, does not speak of the Jews with any affection whatsoever. Nemirovsky was taken from a police station to a transit camp, and from there to Auschwitz, and she went to the gas chamber on the 17th of August, 1942. Epstein didn't know that. He didn't know that she was dead. And his letters, his desperate pleas for mercy, for news of her whereabouts, offering to take his wife's place, continued throughout that month and the next. In October, his own turn came, and early in November, on his arrival at Auschwitz, he too was immediately murdered. It could have been even worse. As you'll know if you've read Primo Levi's If This Is a Man, which we get onto next week, or as you will know when you've read it. Thank you.